Hey, Anna, have you ever noticed that in sci-fi movies, like wherever they go, or any planet they visit, they're always like walking around like normal, like it's Earth?
Yeah.
You know, like the gravity is the same.
Yeah.
Isn't that weird?
I have literally never thought about it.
I think about it all the time. Like we see the Martian movie.
I don't believe,
And Matt Damon, he's on Mars.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh man, are they going to make him look like he's really on Mars or really on Earth? Now, Mars, you weigh 38% of what you weigh on Earth.
So sold. When do we go?
Done.
When are we leaving?
I mean, so if you weigh 100 pounds on Earth, you only weigh 38 pounds on Mars. If you weigh 200 pounds on Earth, you weigh 76 pounds on Mars.
Quick math.
But Matt Damon weighed the same on Earth as he did in Mars.
He had other problems, Dean. He had to grow vegetables.
I know. Those potatoes.
Those potatoes were...
But this is the thing is I wish sci-fi movies would do that kind of thing to show what it'd be really like on other planets, because it would be pretty cool to see like you floating around a little bit more on planets, or the reverse. If you go to a giant planet like Jupiter, you weigh 2.34 times what you weigh on Earth.
No, thank you.
No, that would be pretty tough.
It would be tough.
So let's stick with Mars. You're still on board for Mars.
Yeah, I'm on board for Mars, but I think you should give Matt Damon a break. He had his hands full.
That's true.
Only 38% full, but he had his hands full.
Exactly. From the studios of Cincinnati Public Radio, this is Looking Up, and I'm Dean Regas.
And I'm Anna Heeman, and we're both from the Cincinnati Observatory, where Dean's the astronomer, and I just have a lot of questions. In this episode, we're going to talk about the TRAPPIST-1 solar system with Sean Carey, manager of the Spitzer Science Center. How excited am I supposed to be about TRAPPIST-1? Just so I can gauge my, you know.
Unbelievably excited. Not just 38% excited. You should be you should be Jupiter excited.
Oh, man. I was going to say full 100, but
no, you should be Jupiter excited, because this is the cutting edge astronomy right now. Is everybody's trying to find exoplanets. These are planets that are orbiting other stars. And, you know, maybe 10, 20 years ago, it was kind of a pipe dream that we'd even find a few.
Like, really?
It was something like, oh, well, we might find a few of them out there. But the technology we've got is so precise that they could find these things. Now, we're looking at stars that are trillions of miles away.
Yeah.
And these are these giant balls of gases. They're giving off all this light. And we're trying to find a little teeny tiny planet orbiting around this giant glowing star. It is like looking with your telescope at a flashlight and trying to find a speck of dust on the flashlight. It's really, really difficult.
Yeah.
And so astronomers, when they started doing this, they're like, man, this is really, really difficult. Maybe we shouldn't do this anymore. And they tried to come up with some other ideas. They're like, yeah,
forget it.
But these new waves of telescopes, they came on, became extra sensitive, and they could pick these very little tiny things from this great distance. And so this is the new field. And so it seems like every week we're finding new planets around these other stars. And I think it's more planets than we ever would have thought. Like, if you ask the best, you know, best case scenario, how many planets would be out there? People might say, well, maybe one out of every 1,000 stars or one out of every 100 stars.
Yeah.
We're finding one out of every 5 stars has a planet.
Man.
The more planets, the more places we can go visit someday.
With our dogs.
With our dogs, that's right. See, now, that's how we can get you interested.
Exactly.
Because with all these different planets out there, they have different conditions. So they could be orbiting their star really close. They could have really fast orbits or really slow orbits. They could be made of gases like Jupiter. They could be made of rock like Earth. They could be different sizes. You could have different gravities on there. And the more planets we find, the more places, this is where I'm going to get you on this, is the more places where dog life could exist. And
so
that
exciting.
Is the important thing.
It is so important.
As a dog lover.
As a dog,
You want a place for your dog to go someday
and
meet alien dogs?
Oh, my God. Alien. Now I'm envisioning alien dogs, and oh, my gosh. Yeah, I'm super excited.
I kind of feel a little bad. I think I just got rid of some of my astronomical cred by just mentioning something that's probably not happening. But anyway.
Is our excitement level, like, is it on a scale of, like, how livable and you know, obtainable or inhabitable the planets are, would you say? Or is it like, hey, we're just excited to see them?
I think it's the second. I think you're right. I think mm-hmm. that's what it is, that people see that these planets are Earth-like and that they're Earth-sized and that they're not like giant things like Jupiter or Saturn mm-hmm. where, you know, life couldn't exist because they're all gases. But and then the other thing is we're finding these planets that's in what's called the habitable zone or the Goldilocks zone, where if you're too close to the star, it's going to be too hot.
Yeah.
If you're too far from the star, it's going to be too cold. So where do you want to look?
Right. Where it's just right.
Where it's just right. Exactly. And so that's where we do it. And so we're finding planets. So if we find Earth-like planets that are in the Goldilocks zone, mm-hmm. and then people start thinking, okay, this is a place where life could exist. And it's a big stretch still to say that, but it's at least got people's imaginations going.
Yeah, people seemed really excited. So does it take like, so Spitzer has a special telescope and they do like some fancy, whatever. We're going to learn more about that. You already know about it, I'm sure. I'm going to learn more. But so I guess it takes a special kind of telescope or a special kind of viewing to find these, because to your point, it's you're looking for like in headlights looking for something small or
pretty
whatever.
Much. Yeah. So you need to have a pretty good sized telescope and really an even better camera attached to it so you can detect changes in light. That's the big thing. And probably the best planet hunter out there right now is a telescope called the Kepler Space Telescope. So it's way out in space. Mm-hmm. And what it's doing is looking at stars, a ton of stars at one time, and it's watching for any dips of light, like any minuscule dips of light, and any dips that repeat themselves over and over.
Oh.
So if it repeats, that means something keeps going in front of that star over and over and over again. Yeah. And thus, there you find planets. And so the Kepler Space Telescope has found thousands of these planets that when they're going in front of the star, they're called transiting. And it's just unbelievable the number of planets. I think just last week they said they found another 100 they're adding to the list.
Do you think they're going to change the, like, what mean? Like, we think of planets as like my, you know, every, what is the thing? There's like a mnemonic device.
My very good, educated mother just served us nachos.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes, the
I knew there's
planets.
Something about nachos in there. I'm just going to ruin it. Yeah. So I just wonder, like, we think of, like, we're pretty tied to the idea of this eight planets. We keep using the word planet for all these hundred. I mean, is that still accurate? I mean,
well,
they're planets.
Yes. That is a thorny subject with the astronomers because they, you know, made this definition that said a planet has to circle the sun.
Okay, right.
So that means all these exoplanets are not exoplanets because they're circling not the sun. They're circling another star.
Yeah.
So it was a stupid definition. They should have asked. They should have asked their English major friends instead of. But anyway, but I consider those exoplanets or planets. If they're going around a star, that means it's a planet. And if they're big enough to be detected, that means they're pretty massive and pretty important things in their systems.
Mm-hmm.
And since you were mentioning my very educated mother just served us nachos, I'm going to go even further on the ledge and say, with all those planets, maybe there's another planet that has nachos. Not too far? Did I go too far off the ledge on that one?
I was like, is this a mnemonic device or you just talk about nachos?
Well, you got very excited when you got to the nachos part.
Everybody loves, they're a universal, everyone loves nachos.
And so I'm telling you, there could be planets.
So there could be dogs and nachos?
Dogs and nacho planets.
Pack my bags. I'm ready to go.
I mean, but if you think of how many planets, you know, if there's.
Will I weigh 38%?
And the nachos are 30% off fat. So pretty good.
Yes.
But I mean, think of the whole galaxy. If we have 200 to 400 billion stars in our galaxy and every five of them have a planet, I mean, that's billions and billions of planets. And who knows what kind of things are on these planets. Mostly, they're probably lifeless balls of rock and gas. But
you never know.
The more chances, the more better chances for life.
More bets on the table, the more chance.
That's right. There's more and more info coming out about the TRAPPIST-1 star system. And this is the perfect time to welcome our special guest, Sean Carey. He's a manager of the Spitzer Science Center, home for the Spitzer Space Telescope. Well, Sean, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Well, so with all the different exoplanets that have been discovered in the last decade or so, it seems like there's just so many of them. Why does TRAPPIST-1 get all the attention? It seems like it's like the media darling or the public loves TRAPPIST-1.
Yeah, it's a good question. And the short answer is we know more about the TRAPPIST planets than any other planets outside our own solar system.
Really?
Yeah. So it's an interesting system. And on top of that, it's an interesting system because it's the first system we found that has seven about Earth size and Earth mass planets. So there's a lot of Earth-like-ish balls of, you know, planets there that we can study in more detail. And TRAPPIST is pretty close. It's only about 40 light years from the sun. So that means that this system isn't so far away like some of the more distant Kepler planet systems, that we can do a better job of studying it with telescopes on the ground, telescopes we have now, Kepler and Spitzer, and Hubble, and in the future with James Webb. So that's the excitement about TRAPPIST, is that we know a lot about it now, and we're going to know a lot more about these planets in the not so, you know, in the near future.
And what does, I guess this is maybe a basic question, but what does TRAPPIST stand for? Is it it's an acronym, is that right?
It's an acronym, I'd have to look it up for you. So it was developed by Belgium colleagues.
Okay, so like TRAPPIST monks.
See, this is why I didn't want you to ask me the question. I didn't know the answer either.
They're big fans of the TRAPPIST beer, so that's how they came up.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, TRAPPIST is like a monk, and they make beer, and it's in Belgium.
What does that have to do with stars, though?
See, I know stuff, and you didn't know. Dean didn't know. He didn't want me to ask him in our like chat portion, Sean, just so you know. So he's like, well, ask Sean. I'm like,
you're
okay.
You're supposed to cover me, Sean, on this one. You're supposed to have the answer right at your fingertips.
Sorry about that. We could look it up on the web, though. The thing is, there's more TRAPPIST types of beer than there are planets in the TRAPPIST-1 system.
That's a good thing.
Well, cool. TRAPPIST beers, and they're, including one made in the U.S., I think in New Hampshire. No, Massachusetts, I think.
Uh-huh.
And the rest of them are in Belgium.
Cool.
Well, so there's seven planets orbiting this the star. And
right.
I guess, do you have a favorite? Can you have a favorite out of seven planets that are 40 light years away?
No, you can't really. But what you can say is which one is most interesting because of its maybe similarity to planets in our own solar system.
So you don't want one that's too close or too far.
Right. So these would be the ones that are they get about the same amount of light and heat from their star that Venus, Earth, Mars do, because those are the ones that we consider to be kind of in the habitable zone, that they have the potential to have liquid water on their surface. Of course, we know only Earth has liquid water on its surface. But, you know, under the right conditions with the right atmospheres, Venus and Mars could, and maybe Mars had in the past. So that means the middle planets, so C, D, and E, are the ones that are really interesting.
Oh, so they get the letters A is closest and G is farthest?
No, it's a little confusing because they reserve astronomers, and I don't know why we did this. We should have thought about this a little bit harder. We reserve A for the star, and then all the companions are start with the letter B lowercase, and move outward from that. So we have B, C, D, E, F, G, and H.
Aha. Another question I'm glad you didn't ask me, Anna.
Yeah, really. That was going to be my backup.
Boy,
they're good questions. It doesn't make any sense why we start with B. We don't have
to. It really doesn't.
Aha. So C, D, and E are the ones that are maybe more in the Goldilocks zone kind of thing.
Right, yeah. So C gets about the same amount of illumination and heat radiation as Venus does. And E gets slightly more than Mars. It's like halfway between Earth and Mars. And then F, G, and H are colder. We would expect their surfaces to be colder than Mars. Now, all that being said, you have to remember, the TRAPPIST-1 star is really different than our star. It's a much cooler, smaller star. It's called an ultra-cool dwarf, which means that it's about the size of Jupiter in its radius, and it's much fainter and about half the temperature of the sun. So it doesn't give out as much light. So these planets orbit in much closer. In fact, all these planets orbit much closer to their star than Mercury orbits to to our sun.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's a different sort of system, right? But all other things being equal, if you had the right temperature and the right conditions, then it would be interesting to see what those atmospheres were like.
Cool. So what makes the telescope that you all use at the Spitzer Science Center, what makes it special? Kind of how does it work, and what are you doing with the information it's giving you?
Right. So it's a pretty neat telescope. So it was launched in 2003. It was designed to have a maximum of a five-year mission because it's a telescope that observes infrared radiation. So these are wavelengths of light longer than we can see with our naked eye. So they primarily come from objects that are colder than stars, usually things that emit visible light, or things that are further away and are that light's redshifted, so you can't see it in the visible, but you can see it in the infrared. Because of that, Spitzer had to be kept very cold, because if it wasn't cold, then the infrared light just, you know, we emit in the infrared. So if it was like at room temperature, Spitzer itself would emit so much radiation that you wouldn't be able to see anything with it. So it was designed to be away from the Earth. So it's in an orbit around the sun, just like the Earth, but far away from the Earth. In fact, it's further away from the Earth now than it is from the sun. And it was designed to have a shiny side pointing toward the sun and a side that was painted black pointing away from the sun so that it could, like, absorb the sunlight to power it and then radiate the excess heat in the cold space. And because of that design, even once it ran out of its coolant in 2009, we're still able to operate it. So as far as an engineering achievement, Spitzer is amazing because it's run for way longer than anybody expected it could. But because it can see this infrared radiation, this heat colder radiation that comes from colder objects like the ultra-cool dwarfs, that TRAPPIST-1 type stars are brighter in the infrared than the visible, so it makes it easy to see by Spitzer. And because it's away from the Earth, it's not in the orbit around like the Hubble Space Telescope. It's not, your view isn't getting blocked every time you orbit the Earth. Or if a ground-based telescope, you don't have to worry about, you'd have to worry about the sun coming up and stopping your observations. So the first thing we did with Spitzer for the TRAPPIST-1 system was observe it for 20 days.
Oh, wow.
Continuously, pretty much. And because of that, we're able to detect all the different planets. That's how we're able to find the seven planets, was by the continuous monitoring. Because if you tried to do this from the ground, every time the sun came up, you're essentially missing you're missing every other 12 hours. And it's very hard to disentangle what you're seeing. From the ground, they had thought they had seen a couple of planets, and there was one really weird. So actually, we should probably talk a little bit how you detect the planets, right?
Yeah, good idea.
That interesting? Okay, so we don't see the planets, right? So even though we have these really beautiful graphics on the website and the press releases and thing, we don't know what the planets look like. Those are artist concepts based on the physical information we've been able to get so far and people's understanding of what chemistry should be like. Because we don't actually can't detect the planets by themselves. What we detect is, we're very fortunate with the TRAPPIST system, is that when the planets pass in front of their star, they block out a little bit of the starlight, a very tiny amount, like a percent or less in this case.
So it's like a little
eclipse. And we're able to measure that little change. And every time the planet comes back around, so once it makes another orbit, it blocks out the same amount of light again. So you can tell the size of the planet relative to the size of the star by the amount of the dip in the light that you see as each planet is in front of us.
Okay. Well, so we know some basic things about these planets. We know their sizes. We know their distances from their star. What would be next? What would be some further up things we can do to look at the system a little better?
Right. So there's one other bit of information we know for the TRAPPIST system, which we usually don't get for planets, and we're not able to measure it as well, is that we're able to measure their masses for these planets. And the reason why is, you know how I said, when the planet, as it orbits around the star and then passes in front of us, the light dips. And if there were no other planets in the system, if you just had the star and one planet, every time it, you know, went around and made one orbit or one of its local years, you would see a dip. In the case of the TRAPPIST system, each year the planets is on the time scale of days, because they're orbiting around very close to their star. So every couple of days you'll see a dip from some of the planets. When you measure the timing, though, for the TRAPPIST planets, it's not exact. It doesn't happen on the same cadence. You don't see things. I'll give you an example here. So the innermost one, TRAPPIST-1b, which is very close to its star, it's like a 40th of how close Mercury is to the sun. That orbits every like 1.5 days. But that timing's not exact. And the reason why is it's getting, because all these planets are fairly close to each other, they gravitationally interact, so they tug and pull on each other, and that changes the timing of these dips, these transits that we see, and we're able to measure that. And then we're also, once we, you know, you apply a little, it's all, you apply a little gravitational theory to it, you can figure out the masses of the planets based on the timing, either the lead or the lag from what you would expect if it was just a single planet orbiting the star. It's complicated for TRAPPIST because there's seven planets and they all sort of interact with each other on some level. In fact, each set of three interacts very strongly, and we can kind of predict what we should see if we know what the masses are, and then we're able to actually measure the timing differences, and then we're able to measure the mass from that. So these planets, not only do we know their sizes very well, but we also know their masses very well. We know the masses of these planets and the sizes of these planets better than any other planets outside of the ones in our own solar system, you know, that we're actually able to fly to.
Wow, so you just threw a whole new wrinkle. I thought this system was weird as it is, but if their years change from year to year, like that is, yeah. Imagine if our year
now, their
was...
years change, though, so, you know, their years take days, right? So you'd have a lot of birthdays. If you're orbiting TRAPPIST-1E, which is probably the one that would be most Earth-like, let's see. So that's 6 days. It's 6.1 days would be 1 year there.
A birthday every when 6 days.
Oh, man.
Party planet.
I love it.
Yeah, the timing changes by minutes, though. It changes between, like, a couple minutes, like 2 to 6, to in some cases up to 60 minutes.
Wow.
Depending upon which planet and how it's been interacting with the other planets. Yeah. And the interesting thing about, another interesting thing about this system is that if you're to, like, freeze frame looking at the planets, their orientation, I think it's every 32 days, they get to the same alignment again. Because of these mutual gravitational interactions, they're in something what physicists would call a resonance condition, and that makes the interactions between them very strong, and also very repeatable if you measure from cycle to cycle. So we're able, that's one of the reasons we're able to pin down the masses.
Oh, very cool, very cool. Well, you've definitely helped us out with this because this is such a cool system, and
it really is.
We're so glad to have had you here today. Thanks so much, Sean, for coming on our show.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm glad I could help.
We've been talking with Sean Carey, the manager of the Spitzer Science Center. Thanks so much for joining us, Sean.
All right, so normally this is the time where I'd ask you a kid question. But the kid question I wanted to ask you, which was, what does TRAPPIST stand for?
Yeah, it was too hard. It was way too hard.
Like, this is one Google search away. Oh.
Well, what did our producer
find? Well, our
for
producer,
us?
Thank goodness, found for us that it is what is called a backronym.
Backronym.
I love when people like funny words. Okay, so it's a backronym. So it means transiting planets and planetismal, is that a word? Small telescope.
Wow.
So it's the TRAPPIST. It's a little bit
small
of
telescope.
Of a stretch. But it's named because I guess TRAPPIST beers.
It really
Sean was
trapped.
Right. Yeah, I mean, he was like, but even when we asked him, he didn't know.
See, that's why I told you this kid question was too
hysterical.
Hard.
Hysterical. I'm like, I thought it was a pretty good basic question. You know, kids are curious about it. Nope.
Why couldn't you ask me a simple question? Like, what's your favorite exoplanet, Dean?
I'm not your puppet. Okay. What's your favorite exoplanet, Dean?
Oh, thank you. I'm so glad you asked.
So unexpected of me to ask, right?
My favorite exoplanet in the whole universe is Proxima Centauri B.
You're not a big fan of A?
So remember what
Sean
told us.
That's right, there's not an A.
Yeah, the A is the star itself.
I remember.
I know. I'm glad he told me because I forgot it. So, but now I remember.
Proxima Centauri
B. Okay. Now, the reason why this is my favorite planet is exoplanet is because it's the closest one to us. It is this little planet, rocky planet, Earth-sized, maybe a little bigger than the Earth, and circling around a little red dwarf star. So it's another very small star. But that star, Proxima Centauri, is the closest star to our sun. 4.2 light years away. And so that is exciting because if we have a planet around our closest star, that means, and around this weird star that's this red dwarf star, that means there are planets all over the place. And so this is like the forerunner to some other ones. And it could be one that we could visit someday with a robotic craft if we can get it going really, really fast. And so I hope that sometime in this century we get a close-up view of Proxima Centauri B. I'm wishing. But that's my favorite. That's my favorite one just because of all it says about what's coming up.
Well, way to answer your own kid question, but actually you're an adult astronomer and just wanted to tell me your favorite TRAPPIST exoplanet.
Yep.
I hope everyone enjoyed that.
Yeah, that's why I have a show.
Well, that's it for this episode of Looking Up. Thanks to Sean Carey from the Spitzer Science Center for joining us. And we want to hear from you, so get in touch with us. We're on Facebook, just search Looking Up, and on Twitter at Looking Up Podcast. You can also drop us a note or comment at lookingup@wvxu.org.
You can ask us a question, give us a topic suggestion, or ask your kids what they'd like to ask an astronomer or scientist, and we can try to answer them on future episodes.
And remember to subscribe to Looking Up on iTunes and rate us there or on Stitcher. You can also subscribe at wvxu.org/lookingup. Our theme song and additional music is by Y, that's W-H-Y question mark, from their album Moline, courtesy of Joyful Noise Recordings and Terror Bird Media.
Looking Up is a production of Cincinnati Public Radio. Kevin Reynolds is our producer, Josh Elstro is our engineer, and Jim Nolan provides additional technical assistance.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm Anna Heeman.
And I'm Dean Regas. Keep looking up.